Back to our 1995 interview with Jerry Stahl. His memoir, Permanent Midnight, about his life when he was a TV writer and junkie, is out in paperback this month.
Here's what I'd like to know. I mean, you're a very educated guy. So you knew about how addicting heroin is, and you'd already had a lot of idols in music and literature who died as a result of their habits. So when you shot heroin the first time, did you think that you'd take your chances? I mean, knowing how dangerous it was?
Well, I wasn't viewing it as a career move at the time. I had been high pretty much every day for maybe 15 or 16 on one thing or another, so it was no big deal to try another drug. And long-term planning was not really my forte, so I guess I didn't look at the larger picture. At that moment, it was the right thing to do, and I dug it.
Did you have friends who were doing it?
Oh, yeah, I did. In the beginning, and in L.A., I hung out with some people who were doing it for a while. But, you know, by the end, it was just me. And when I was in TV, it was just me.
I know that your father committed suicide, and your mother tried and failed, but landed in a coma for a while. I mean, I think it's probably fair to say that your family was, like, predisposed to, terrible depression. Do you think that that somehow contributed to your use of drugs?
Well, I definitely had the misery gene, that's for sure, that made drugs for me very appealing because on some level they kept me alive for a long time. I don't think I could have gotten through my teens and my 20s, both of which are essentially like a black hole, without being high all the time. And
Why not?
Because it was the only way I could not face what I had been through growing up and how depressed I was and all the weirdness and terror and deep-rooted torment I couldn't even handle. So I'm not advocating it, and it would have been much better probably to go to terrific shrinks and have it all ironed out. But for me, in that situation, pot and hallucinogens and speed and downs and what have you, it sort of just kept me afloat. In some ways, I feel very fortunate that I was able to just hit the bottom and collapse like I did, because now that I'm clean, I don't have to worry about working through all those problems. It's just gravy that I'm even walking around.
A lot of people who have given up alcohol or drugs say that you have to hit bottom before you can really give it up. Seems to me you hit bottom several times and kept going back for more. I mean, like, one of the times you hit bottom and it wasn't over yet was when your baby was born. Do you want to tell what happened?
I tell it only because it shows where you can go, and it illustrates the fact that when you are a junkie, no matter what's going on, what you are is a junkie taking care of your habits. So to make a long story short, I was in the OBGYN men's room while my daughter was being delivered, and I had ducked in there to get off, and right in the middle of it, the nurse came in and said, "Hey, it's happening. Put on these scrubs." And of course, as I said before, I didn't wear short-sleeve shirts, and scrubs are a sterile short-sleeve garb that you wear in a delivery room. And I put those on rather hastily and ducked into the room where my child was being delivered at that very moment. And of course, I hadn't cleaned myself up. I was still bleeding slightly from the crook of my arm. And I looked at the doctor, and I just saw this level of contempt in his eyes, for which there's really no adjective. And he just looked at me as if to say, with a father like you, that child might as well go back where she came from, because what chance does she have? And to make matters worse, soon enough, the baby was born, and the nurse is handing me the scissors and saying, "Cut the umbilical." And at that moment, it's as if I had never done heroin before, and the rush was like one I had never experienced. I was weak in the knees and seeing double. And I kind of lurched forward to cut the umbilical cord, and by the grace of God, I avoided giving my child a third eye or my wife an impromptu hysterectomy and managed to cut the cord. But that was the mother of all bottoms. But as you say, it didn't stop me.
How come you think it didn't stop you? I mean, I'm just trying to understand more about what addiction's like, because people say, you know, you bottom out and that helps you, but it's hard to imagine much more of a bottom than that.
It's very simple. It is such a horrifying thing to have done that the mere memory of it, the mere realization that it happened, was so horrifying to me that I had become such an animal that I had to get high to obliterate the recollection of what I had done.
So was there another bottoming out that led you to actually want to kick as opposed to using more drugs to obliterate the memory?
I was always trying. I was in hospitals, rehabs, halfway houses. I kicked, as they say, in the street, cold turkey a number of times. But what it took for me was during the L.A. uprising when I was living in a garage and had no car and no bathroom and was just kind of on a concrete floor. And one day the Rodney King thing went down and I was stumbling south to get a Perrier to 7-Eleven or some water or something. And I noticed that the 7-Eleven looked different. And of course, what it was a Buick sticking out of the plate glass window. And I stumbled in and got my water and subsequently got rounded up by the cops and had the horrific revelation I was being arrested for looting a Perrier, which is about the whitest thing a man can do. And this being L.A., this cops, you know, kept all the people of color and said, you get the hell out of here. And I went back to the garage and I tried to go catch a bus to cop and the buses weren't running. And I tried to call my connection and the phones were dead. So over the course of those days, the city was burning and so was I. And I finally stumbled out, I guess, two and a half days later, completely naked in this patch of grass, staring at the skies. It was kind of raining black feathers or something, as if I had died and awoken in a Garcia Marquez story. And what that was, of course, was ash. It was, the sky was black from all the burning buildings. And I just came to, like that moment in The Wizard of Oz when the house stops spinning and Dorothy steps out and the movie goes from black and white to color. I made it to the other side.
So did you kick alone in the garage?
Yeah. Completely alone, cut off, and just occasionally staring at this image when the power was on of people looting buildings and seeing my face reflected on the TV screen so that it was as if people were looting appliances out of my forehead. And I just remember thinking, you know, go ahead, take it. You know, whatever is in my head, I don't need anymore.
So what is your life like now? It's been how many years that you've been clean?
Yeah, it's been a couple of years. I'm really a very boring guy. You know, I'm just, I don't drink. I only have coffee on like national holidays because at this point my liver lives out of state. I washed ashore. You're laughing. I'm dying. I have hepatitis C.
That is more Amsterdam.
I have the cello right here and I'll be happy to play a tune and Pickles is waiting in the wings. You know, I live a very dull life on one level, but for a dope fiend who's been where I've been, you know, if you're a junkie, life is very black and white. You know everything that's going to happen. You either have the dope or you don't. It's real simple. You're going to be sick. You're going to be well. Now that I'm clean, every day is nothing but gray area. It's really the last frontier. I think it's the sheer novelty and weirdness of life on the Natch that keeps me plugging away. So, you know, I write in the mornings, whatever. Take care of my daughter in the afternoons, pick her up at school.
When you were writing back in the days when you were getting high all the time, you were, mm-hmm. you know, writing for television, you were writing for things you had contempt for. Then you not only had to deal with living without drugs, but you started to write a memoir, something that you couldn't have contempt for. I mean, you had to write something that you were able to stand by. You can't blame it on the guy who wrote the pilot or on the producer, or on the taste of the American public. It's your writing. Did that make everything even harder? Or was that a good opportunity to really throw yourself into something that you cared about?
Both of those things. It was terrifying on one level because, as you say, there's no place to hide. And for me, having written high all my life, what you realize was words for me were a means of sort of obfuscating the truth. You know, you could use words to dance around anything real. And I was very much about style and less about substance. I was a flashy, kind of gonzoed out writer and never wrote about myself. Probably never wrote an honest word, for that matter. And suddenly I get clean, and I had given up writing because I was so convinced I couldn't do it anymore. Then I published an article in a magazine out here called LA Style. And from that got the book deal. And then it just became this weird sort of, once I started, it was as if I had been waiting my whole life to spill these beans, you know? It was just one long exhalation. To say it was a catharsis is almost an understatement. It was just like a sustained explosion. I wrote 1,200 pages in about 9 months, which is mortifying in itself. But, you know, having done that and gotten through the other side and edited it down to 400, leaving a lot of the gnarly stories on the floor, I just really feel like that is over, thank God. And, you know, whatever's left is left, but I guess I can relax a little bit.
Back in your drug days, you used to wear black all the time, long sleeves, black leather coat. Do you still dress the same way?
I'm all about festive pastels now, Terry. I just think it's all about mauve and... Yeah, it's just how I am. Right now, if you could see me, it's just a cornucopia of pastel. Everything's changed about me.
So tell me, do you ever...
White shoes. I'm going to full Cleveland. White shoes, white belt, full leisure. I look great.
Jerry Stahl, recorded in 1995. He is apparently still clean and still writing. His memoir, Permanent Midnight, is out in paperback this month. A movie adaptation starring Ben Stiller is scheduled for release next year.